This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Right here on 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Good morning. Welcome to the New Capital Show. Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you this morning on October 2nd, a beautiful day here in Houston, Texas. www.newcapitalshow.com is our website, and of course, coming to you from the studios at 90.1 KPFT. We're going to be talking today, just as we were last week, about the ongoing financial crisis and all sorts of issues associated with that. We'll be taking your calls a bit later in the show, maybe 15 minutes in or so. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, and we will go, of course, until 11 o'clock a.m. talking about the issues and taking your calls. I got a number of emails saying what happened to last week's show. Didn't see it on the website. Wasn't available for podcasting. I want to tell everybody I'm very sorry. The hurricane has impacted our technology here at the studio in all sorts of ways. Computer networks not quite working the way they're supposed to, and the recording server here at KPFT, the server that records the shows automatically, and then we're able to pick up the file and put it on our website, that server was not working last week. So the words that you heard on our two-hour special that we did with George Ryder, my colleague at Thresholds, those went out into the ether, floated up into the clouds, and are now lost forever. I'm sorry. So if anything wasn't clear last week, I'll try to make it clear this week, and I'll have some additional things to say about the credit crisis and see if I can maybe clarify a few things as well for you. The server is working this week, and we'll have the show posted later today. Still recovering from the hurricane. I didn't say this last week, but I want to say that I think that public officials here in the city of Houston have really done a great job. I'm sure they haven't done a perfect job, but I think they've done an excellent job. The mayor's office, the county public officials, maybe some of you have had issues or problems, but it seems to me that the response has been very good and very compassionate, and I think it's going to continue to be such. I was with one of those crews. I stopped one of the crews that are picking up the debris, and I asked them how long it's going to be to get the city back to normal and to have everything picked up and straightened up. They think it's going to be a year. 1 year. It takes a year to recover from a major hurricane like that. So let's turn to our main topic today, the ongoing financial crisis. You know, as a financial advisor, people depend upon me to help them try to see some clarity through this episode, and I'll try to help us do that today. And the way I try to get some clarity is I meditate. I sit and meditate. I sit on a cushion and do that. And this past weekend, I did what most people should be doing, which is I went on a meditation retreat. Went on a meditation retreat to a very beautiful, special place north of the city, up toward Conroe. This is a very interesting city we have. A group of Chinese, I don't know if they're citizens now, but the originally Chinese nationals are here. They have acreage north of the city, and they have a commune where they work and they build and they eat together, they meditate together, and they offered our group, totally free of charge, their facilities for the weekend so that we could hold a meditation retreat. And this is really this is really the spirit that the world needs to go forward in, sitting in meditation, loaning each other our meditation retreats. Our teacher is a renowned teacher, comes from the world-renowned San Francisco Zen Center, and I had expected as the sun went down on Friday night that he was going to fully focus on matters of the spirit, wasn't going to focus on any parochial worldly issues like financial crises, right, or hurricanes. We were going to launch immediately with his wisdom and his teaching into much higher, more ephemeral thoughts about, you know, the essence of being. How are we to be in this world? How are we to drop attachment? How are we to become more comfortable with ourselves? How are we to simply be in the moment? It shows what I know, because our teacher, you know, basically immediately launched as the sun went down comments on Friday night. So we have this international financial crisis. And it's entirely appropriate. That's what Zen masters do. They constantly surprise you, right? They surprise you. And there he was surprising us in his immediate discussion about what is on many people's minds, certainly in the forefront of what appears in the media, the thing that is getting talked about by people, the main conversation piece along with the election. And he immediately launched into these, not in a basic way, but in a higher way, to talk about what do we have with this crisis? What is this crisis? And of course, a great teacher lending all types of insight, including the insight that we are always in crisis. When are we not in crisis? Crisis is movement. Crisis is change. Otherwise, what is the opposite of crisis? Stasis. Something that doesn't change. Something that is static and stuck. And so, just that one insight, I said, yeah, hey, that's right, that's it. The crisis we're in now, it may have a higher amplitude to it, a greater magnitude to it, but really what we're witnessing is people becoming more aware. We have an awareness increase that is going on of problems and issues and structural things that we need to take care of, that we need to improve. The crisis has always been with us. Change is always with us. That is the Buddhist viewpoint, of course. And upon hearing those words, I said, yes. This is something that everybody should be understanding, that we're going through a process of change, and hopefully we're going to make some changes. We're going to make some changes for the better. Certainly, we need that to happen in our financial system. Certainly, we need to see greater regulations. And just to help you understand where I think a lot of the regulations that will come about are going to be directed, let me talk about that for just a second. What we have seen is enormous amounts of debt having been taken on across the country at the household level, but certainly at the corporate level, and especially at the banking level, and even more so at the level of investment banks, many of which we've now seen either taken over or have gone bankrupt in the case of Lehman Brothers. And the way that these investment banks and other financial institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been financed is they have had short-term borrowings. They have relied upon short-term borrowings. Sometimes those borrowings renew overnight. Sometimes the borrowings, you know, can be called the next morning by the lender. And they've turned around, and why have they relied on that financing? Why is that type of financing so attractive? That financing is attractive because it's cheap, right? If you're giving somebody an overnight loan, you can generally say, well, I'm not going to pay you that much interest. I'm going to pay you back tomorrow morning. So why should I pay you 10% interest? You're not loaning me the money for two decades. You're loaning me the money overnight. So I'm going to pay you 2%. And this went on overnight after overnight after overnight. Every morning, the investment banks would wake up and say, okay, we want you to renew. We want you to renew our 2% loan. And everybody said, okay, you got it, 2% for another 24 hours. And the investment banks would go out and acquire assets with this money. Or the banks would go out and acquire assets with the money. And what were the assets? The assets were longer term in nature, right? A mortgage. Mortgages don't tend to be 24 hours, folks, do they? Now, we've seen some awfully short mortgages, right? One-year arms, two-year arms. But in general, mortgages are longer-term assets. 15-year mortgages. Hell, I've got a 30-year mortgage. Somebody's agreed to loan me money for 30 years at a fixed interest rate. That's nuts to me, but hey, they're willing to do it, fine. And so you have a critical source of instability in any financial institution. And frankly, friends, we saw this back in the SNL. What is it? We have what's called maturity mismatch. We have short-term finances with long-term assets. That is a big problem. And it is one of the things that, one of the main things, along with the rush to invest at ever higher price levels in residential real estate in this country, this maturity mismatch has caused enormous instability. And it hasn't just happened at the level of the investment banks. Think about the mortgages that people have taken out. Somebody says, I want to buy a house. Okay, how long you want to live in the house? Of course, that question wasn't being asked by the brokers and the realtors and so forth. But the assumption would be most people want to live in the house on average, you know what, 10 years? And they would be put into mortgages that would reset with their interest rate after 1 or 2 years, 3 years. Maturity mismatch. If you're going to buy an asset, you generally want to make sure that the financing of that asset is going to match the duration of the time that you're going to hold the asset. And so what has happened to the investment banks? What's happened to Bear Stearns? What's happened to Lehman Brothers? What was happening to Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, frankly, has been happening to them, but that they were able to stave off total bankruptcy. Remember those overnight loans I was telling you about? Well, one morning everybody woke up who was offering those loans, life insurance companies and pension funds and on, and they said, the investment bank said, the bank said, okay, it's another morning. We want you to go ahead and lend us the money for another 24 hours. And guess what the answer was one day? No. No, thank you. Give us our loan back. We're taking our ball and going home. Now, what do you have to do if you're going to pay them back? You got to come up with cash. And the magnitude of these short-term borrowings, I'm not saying that this was a little part of their balance sheet, right? This wasn't a little part of their balance sheet. This was an enormous part of their balance sheet. Huge amounts of very short-term borrowings. You know, 33% of the entire financing of the bank. Maybe more, maybe 50, maybe half. And on that one morning, the lenders said, with regard to 33% of the size of their balance sheet, we want our loans back. Why did they want their loans back? Because they have no idea what the assets are worth on the balance sheet, on the asset side. And they don't want to be the last ones holding the bag. So they said, give us our money back. And a lot of them started to say, give us our money back. So if you are Lehman Brothers with a balance sheet that's, I don't know what the size of it is, huge, $500 billion, and $200 billion is being demanded to be paid back. What do you have to do? You have to come up with the cash. So how do you get the cash? Answer, you have to sell assets. You have to sell assets. And what are the assets that they have on their balance sheet that they have to sell? Answer, mortgage-backed securities. The very securities that the U.S. government, in the form of the Treasury, with permission from the Congress, this is the bailout plan. These are the very securities that the investment banks and the banks need to sell to raise cash to pay back lenders who are demanding their money because they are no longer satisfied to be paid 2% to lend the money overnight. They don't think it's reflective of the risk of the institution to which they're lending. Now, the bailout has not, the so-called bailout, the rescue, call it what you will, has not passed Congress. It was voted on in a newly amended form last night by the Senate, and it passed rather overwhelmingly, 75-25, 3-1. And it's now going to head back to the House. But even though that particular bill has not been signed into law, don't think that there has not been a bailout going on behind the scenes, because there has. The Federal Reserve of this country, the central bank, its primary job is to be the lender of last resort. It's one of the primary jobs. The other is to control the money supply, the amount of dollars that are sloshing through the system. That's the money supply, and they do that by buying and selling, usually, treasury bonds on the open market, just like you and me. That's how the Federal Reserve controls the money supply. They enter, and it's usually the Federal Reserve branch in New York that enters the market and buys or sells treasuries, and that either puts money into the system or takes money out of the system. The Federal Reserve can also make loans directly to banks. And my friends, the Federal Reserve has been making loans directly to banks. And that number is probably itself pushing up toward about $1 trillion. That would be my guess about where that number stands. Why? Well, again, as the lenders are demanding their money back from the banks, banks have to come up with the cash. The banks are not able to sell because we have a credit crisis going on. And we have a liquidity crisis with regard to these mortgage-backed securities. Nobody trusts them. We have had a lack of trust. And isn't that appropriate, and isn't that perfectly metaphorical for what's really gone on in our country? Huh, lack of trust. Here we are at the end of the Bush years, and we have a rampant what? I mean, we have a lack of confidence, and we have a lack of trust. Here I am, having come back from a meditation retreat with a group of other people where trust is paramount. The trust that other people will be quiet. The trust that other people will pull their share of the work over the course of the weekend. We'll do the cooking. Trust that others will do the cleaning. Trust that everyone will do their part and uphold the integrity and the respect and the trust of everyone else. That is a far cry from where we stand right now on October 2nd of 2008. There is not a lot of trust in the system. Everyone wants their loan back. They want their money back. They want it in their account, and they don't want it loaned to anybody else. And so the Federal Reserve has stepped in to provide money to the banks so that the banks can continue to do what they do. What they're supposed to do, which is to make loans, to provide liquidity to people. But guess what? Banks aren't doing that. The banks are hoarding the cash that they are borrowing from the Federal Reserve, because they don't trust you, and you don't trust them. The banks are worried that any day you're going to go to the bank and say, I want my deposit back. I I want to put it under my mattress. I don't know where you're going to put it, but that's what the banks are concerned about. So, my friends, the only way that we're going to get out of this crisis is to meditate. Is to practice Zen. Is to practice trust. We have to trust those of us who are inclined to trust. We may have to trust those of us who are not quite totally inclined to trust. I don't mean blindly trust. Yes, we need to make sure mechanisms are there. My money is still in my brokerage account. I trust the firm I'm with. I verify things, and then I trust. But I also diversify. It is critical that you diversify. Let me read you a quick story about why that's important. Let's see if I can find this thing here. I saw this yesterday. Where is it? Wall Street Journal. This is from yesterday. I don't know, some of you may have seen this article. It's very sad. Loyalty pays a bitter dividend, October 1st, 2008. Grace Pace, a 72-year-old widow, says her husband invested years ago in a local bank in Biloxi, Mississippi. Over time, that tiny bank was acquired and reacquired until it became part of giant Wachovia Corporation. Still, Mrs. Pace and her husband, a Biloxi physician, held on. It was a point of pride in her family to have a stake in the local bank. On Monday, the day Wachovia was broken up in a forced sale to Citigroup, Mrs. Pace was in tears. Wachovia's dividend once provided a third of her income. That money is now gone. She said, "You just think, this cannot be happening. What is security? And what is secure anymore?" Mrs. Pace said her son recently reassured her that if things get really bad, she can move out of her home and into his basement, which has a window. Then she began to cry again. Variations of Mrs. Pace's story are playing out in households nationwide. The financial crisis is overwhelming some of America's most loyal investors, individuals who've held on to bank stocks for years or even generations. The article goes on to talk about the history of Americans and bank stocks. My point in bringing this article to your attention is just very simple. And I've said this over and over. And anyone who listens to KPFT and Pacifica, you deserve to hear this as well as anyone else. You need to hold a diversified portfolio. I'm not going to tell you that a diversified portfolio has not taken hits in the past month, past year. It has. But there is a big difference between seeing your portfolio down 10%, 15%, and seeing it down 98% or 100%. Okay? If you have a 401k, you need to look at it. Those of you who have 401ks and 403bs, you're among the most underserved people in the area of financial advice. Right? You get a job, they give you a piece of paper, you fill it out, you put the best thing you can down on it. Maybe you pick the right allocation, maybe you don't, I don't know. But you need to look at it. And you need to just simply pay attention to some simple things. What is the amount of stock versus bonds that you have in the account? Now, I'm not here to give you financial advice today. It's not something that the station, you know, really is here to do. But I'm going to give you some pointers that are simply basic facts of prudence, as it is practiced by law in the United States. And diversification is the primary principle of prudence, the primary underpinning of prudence, of prudent investment. If you have 100% stocks in your portfolio, in your 401k, hey, right? It's like eating chocolate chip cookies. The first one's really incredible. The second one's still really, really incredible. The third one, still great. The fourth one, yeah, it's still really good. The seventh one, I don't know. I could do without. The eighth one, I'm sick of cookies. Nine, please, I don't want to see another cookie. It's the same thing with stocks and bonds. Right? 100% stocks, by the time you've passed 60, by the time you've passed, let's say 50, 60, 70, 80% in stocks, you're not doing yourself much good once you go to 85, 90, 95, 100% stocks. The stronger returns that stocks over time generally have versus bonds, the goodness of that has been brought to you at 50, 60, 70%, even 80%. But beyond that, you begin to take on risk at a much faster rate than you do return. And it's the same thing in the other direction. You want 100% bonds? Well, look, once you've passed a certain amount in bonds, the diversification benefit, the insurance qualities, the defensive qualities that bonds bring to you, that begins to dissipate, and you begin to lose returns faster than you reduce volatility. So if you have a 401k account or a 403b account, take a look at it and try to understand what's the stock versus bond division here. And if it doesn't look healthy and balanced, you might want to take some steps to make it so. More balanced. I don't know where exactly the balance for you should be. It depends upon your age. If you're very young, you might be able to have 80% stocks and 20% bonds. But if you're moving toward retirement, it's probably not the best allocation for you. Maybe 50-50. Maybe even more bonds than stocks. Maybe 40% bonds and 60% stocks. You may want to hold a little bit of cash. This is common sense. If you don't know what you're holding in your portfolio, ask somebody to help you. Call the 401k administrator. Say, I need some help. Can you help me understand what I'm holding? Can you help me understand what is the amount of stock percentage versus bonds? And within each of those categories, stocks versus bonds, some of your stocks may be U.S. stocks. Some of your stocks may be foreign stocks. Again, you don't want to go overboard in any one direction. It's like chocolate chip cookies. Although, frankly, I got to confess, I could probably eat chocolate chip cookies happily, nonstop. That's Laura, what's your weakness?
Chocolate and peanut butter ice cream.
Chocolate separate from peanut butter ice cream, or the two together?
The kind that is together.
The mixture. Chocolate peanut butter ice cream.
Yeah.
You could keep going on that.
It's hard to.
Till you stop.
It's hard to stop.
Yeah. All right. So I hope that's helpful. I hope that's helpful to you to think about. Please look at your investments. Don't cover your eyes. And make sure that you have a good allocation. It's going to be the best thing to get through these times. Okay? Don't just sit there. This is your future. This is your capital. It's important that you preserve your capital. And it's important that you have a diversified portfolio. Don't end up like, what's her name? Ms. Pace, the 72-year-old widow in Biloxi. Don't end up like that. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't put all of your savings into Wachovia stock. That company no longer exists. Don't put all your savings into any one company or any one bond. Municipal bonds have been the most boring, staid area of the bond world, you know, for decades now. They don't make a whole lot, and they don't really lose money. Oops! Until the past year, when municipal bonds that are backed by the taxes, local taxes in our cities and towns, have lost 5%, 7%, 10%. 10%, that's a lot to lose on municipal bonds. Am I telling you not to hold municipal bonds? No. It's okay to hold municipal bonds. It just shouldn't be 100% of your portfolio, and it shouldn't be 100% of your bond portfolio. Right? Because what have we seen occur in the bond world in the past couple of weeks? What type of bond has held up very, very well? The U.S. Treasury bond. So if you have a portfolio that has some foreign bonds, it has some municipal bonds, and it has some treasury bonds, yes, you've lost some money in the past few weeks. But you haven't lost everything. And your holdings in treasury bonds have helped to buffer and lower the volatility in your portfolio. There will come a day when treasury bonds do not do well and municipal bonds do well. If your portfolio is diversified and balanced, you will participate in that day as well. Very, very important. I cannot stress to you enough the need to be diversified. Don't hold your hands over your eyes. Now is the time for you to take a look at your portfolios and your 401ks and your 403bs and understand how it's allocated. Please do that. And get help if you're not sure what you're looking at. You deserve help. You deserve help, and you can get help. Please get help if you need to get help. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. There are going to be brighter days ahead. We're going through change. Crisis is change. Stasis is not the way the world is. Progress and crisis, these things come hand in hand. Just as Buddhism teaches, there is no duality. There is no life and death. These are the same things. And crisis and change, they're the same things. Let's go to line one. Eugene, and by the way, folks, our phone system is still limping along. Usually I have a computer screen right in front of my face that tells me what line you're on and your name. And today, Laura's going to take your name and tell me what line you're on. So just bear with today. First line, first call of the day, 713-526-5738. We've got 30 minutes left in the New Capital Show. First up is Eugene. Hey, Eugene, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. You never fail to inform.
Well, good.
Hey, I wanted to see if I have a... I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around this whole bailout thing. I wanted to ask you a question because I'm sure you understand it a lot better than I do. I heard someone throw out the number $61 billion. It said that would be enough to buy every distressed loan in the country. And I did some quick math. You know, if there's a million distressed loans and they're average $200,000 a piece, well, that would be $200 billion. So there's something else going on, obviously. And so, I mean, I know that the banks issued these no-interest, no-asset loans and then got them rated as AAA. Is what happened next that they used them as security, like 20% down, to borrow some much larger sum and then made some risky investments that have gone bad? Is that what's going on here? And then I have an ancillary question, too.
The number, Eugene, that you're throwing out is $60 billion. You're saying that there are numbers being thrown out that say that a significantly reduced number from the $700 billion proposed by Secretary Paulson would get the job done? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm questioning this right-wing line that the entire problem is that they, you know, that a few bad loans were made, they don't say it, but they mean, you know, minorities and stuff, and that's what's caused all the problem, is that these loans have gone bad and that's where all the money went. I'm saying that doesn't sound true to me. And I heard someone, and I don't remember who, on a radio show throw out the number $61 billion. And I'm saying, you know, that I did a quick calc and came up with a number, possibly, you know, ballpark figure of $200 billion, you know. And so I'm trying to figure out if where the entire number went. Was it that these loans were used as security to secure larger loans by the banks? You see what I'm saying? And that those loans went bad.
Eugene, I don't have a good handle on this myself, on what's the number and who has the loans. Certainly we know that real estate went way too far, way too fast in particular parts of the country. Not necessarily ours, But but in California, in Florida, in Arizona, in Las Vegas, in certain parts of the East Coast, some of the higher higher populated areas like perhaps New York and Boston, although New York has held up well, we've seen also problems in the so-called Rust Belt, the Midwest and Ohio and Pennsylvania, places like that.
Well, the general question I'm asking is these housing loans.
Yeah, okay.
They don't account for the entire $700 billion or trillion, do they? Is there some other funny business going on at higher levels?
Okay. As I said last week, the way these loans have been put together is they have been packaged. They have been securitized. And that is one of the major changes between this financial crisis related to real estate and the previous one that was based in savings and loans. And in between those years, let's call it two decades, in between those two decades, the way that real estate is financed has utterly changed. It used to be that a savings and loan would issue a mortgage and would then hold the mortgage on the balance sheet, right?
Right.
And we can all think of what a balance sheet looks like in our heads. On the left-hand side are assets, and on the right-hand side are liabilities. And the major liability of a bank, usually, is deposits. Why is a deposit a liability? A deposit is a liability on the right-hand side of the balance sheet because it's a source of financing. When we say liability, it's the same thing as source of financing, right? Because the people who you owe money to in an institution are those who are providing your financing. Why do you owe them money? Because they've provided financing to you, and they want their financing back, including a return on the financing.
Right.
Okay? So in the old days, a savings and loan would take your deposit off just you and me walking in off the street. We would get a passbook, and we would deposit our money there, and they would pay us a rate of interest, call it 5%. And they would turn around, and they had another part of the bank, a second part of the bank, not the teller part, but, you know, the inside lobby part of the bank. And what went on inside the lobby part of the bank? People who needed money to do projects would come in to borrow the money. And you would borrow it if you needed a business loan. But very often, the loan would be made on residential real estate. Why? Because that's a firmer form of collateral than a business, right? Businesses are generally viewed as a riskier project than a land with a house on it.
Right.
There's something to seize in the event that somebody doesn't pay their loan. Whereas, who wants to seize someone else's business? Right? There may be cash there, but generally, you know, it's the value of the business is in the ongoing business that's going to be done in the future years. Well, the bank doesn't want to run a business. That's why it's harder to get a business loan and why it's more expensive in terms of the interest rate to get a business loan than it is to get a housing loan. Because in the event that someone defaults on a mortgage, the bank can take a physical asset, the land with the house on it. So that's what happened in the savings and loan, is that the bank would then try to get 8% or 9% or 10% or whatever on the mortgage while it was paying the depositors 5%. And the difference between the two is what's called profit. The bank is getting 8%. Now, what happened is that with the advent of securitization on Wall Street, we really developed the ability to take a bunch of assets, smoosh them together into one big pool, right, and then sell all sorts of investors a little share of that pool. Just like you get a little share of the stock of a company, you get a share of stock, you can buy a bond which represents a pro rata, a proportional share of a pool of mortgages.
Right.
Okay? And that's how that business began. You would get a big pool of mortgages, let's say, from Houston, Texas, right?
And then the people that owned those instruments used them as collateral to borrow larger sums of money. Is that right?
You're saying the banks used those to borrow larger sums of money?
Yeah, weren't those instruments used as collateral to borrow even larger sums of money?
Yes. That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
The banks,
as I was saying earlier today, what the investment banks would then do is they would hold large amounts of these mortgage-backed securities on their assets, and they would go and try to get even cheaper financing, short-term financing, super short-term financing, overnight financing.
Right.
And they would go to a pension fund or a, you know, and it would create a very short-term overnight financing, often called a repo financing. And they weren't the only ones issuing this type of very short-term financing. You would get a company like General Electric that would issue overnight, which is also a very large financial company, short-term financing. Short-term financing.
And so they were borrowing larger sums of money. That's what I've done.
Yes, at very cheap rates.
Okay, I got you.
Overnight to hold this type of security.
Okay, and so now one of the proposals is that I heard, if I understood it correctly, and this is what I want to know, is whether or not I think one of the sweeteners that the House Republicans wanted to put in there was to allow the banks to need even less security to borrow larger sums of money.
Okay, that I don't know about. What I do think we're going to see is actually the opposite.
Which would make sense.
What the banks are trying to do now is deleverage. They're trying to lower the amount of debt they have versus the amount of equity they have on their balance sheets. Because,
well, I think one of the proposals was to do exactly the opposite of that. If I heard it correctly, that's
Eugene,
what I was curious about.
Eugene, it wouldn't surprise me.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, great to have you. Another point, friends, when we're talking about subprime mortgages or we're talking about Alt-A mortgages, what you need to understand is that originally there weren't all these different types of mortgages. There was just kind of a 30-year mortgage and a 15-year mortgage, and the securitization of mortgages began with just a big pool. Then Wall Street got cute. Wall Street said, you know what? We can further subdivide those pools, right? We can divide it into people who are high-risk borrowers or people who are in higher-risk parts of the country. And we can therefore demand sell those bonds at a higher interest rate because they're riskier. And that's when we got into different tranches, CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. It wasn't enough to just have a mortgage-backed security, a pool of mortgages. They had to subdivide the mortgages into all sorts of different profiles to get to slice and dice it differently so that you could get even different interest rates with different tenors and terms. And that's when we got people holding bonds that are basically all subprime bonds. And those bonds have, of course, done horribly. They're almost all going to default. As to the lower number that Eugene's talking about, $60 billion, the number I've heard related to $60 billion is that's the amount of interest. That's the amount of interest that would have to be paid on these bonds if you were the owner of these bonds and you had to somehow back the interest payments on the bonds. So that it's not a $700 billion a year purchase. What the government simply has to do, which when you think about it this way, reduces the cost of the so-called bailout, is the government just has to cover the interest payments to bondholders. And that's a significantly reduced amount. Okay, line two, Toby. Toby, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Well, it's great to be on it. I'm glad you took my call. I've been listening to you for a few months now, and I'm quite frankly, as an ex-Wall Street worker, I'm happy to see someone come up with a different line on things, and I appreciate your thoughts.
Great. What's on your mind? Great to have you, Toby.
Okay, really, real quickly, I just want to talk to you about your bond portfolio, and I just want to ask you, when you talk about losing money on your municipals, aren't you meaning you lose value, not necessarily the money, until they default?
Okay, that's right. If you hold a bond to maturity, then it matures and pays you back your money, then yes, you will get your capital back. It doesn't work that way in a bond fund. If you hold a bond fund trades at a certain net asset value because there's no terminal date. There's no expiration date for a bond fund. The idea of a bond fund is that it's going to go into perpetuity. But in either of those cases, on any particular day of trading, your value of your bond may be impaired. And,
that's correct.
And that's the goal of investing. It's not so much to bring in income or to hold a bond to maturity. Those are tactical issues.
Mm-hmm.
The entire strategy of investing is to maximize your net worth.
Right.
And so anything that happens that impairs the value of your bond is going to impact your net worth. It's going and it could result in, it could result in a loss. Why does it result in a loss in a loss on the bond? It may not be a permanent loss, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
it lowers the value. Is basically what
it impairs the value, so that if you were
exactly.
to sell the bond, you would not be getting full par value for the bond, and you couldn't redeploy your capital fully because you're not getting your full capital out of the bond. So there is an effect. It affects net worth. It affects portfolio allocations, and it's
right.
something that should be taken seriously. I'm not telling people not to hold their bonds to maturity, and that may be the very best thing that you can do, but it does impact the value of your portfolio.
Exactly. And another point I want to mention is that I said I was working on Wall Street for a while back, but that was when we used to do IOs, POs, floaters, inverse floaters, where they took the collateralized Ginnie Mae's bonds and they tore them up and they sold them out as different tranches and different products.
Right. These are so-called strips,
yeah.
where you would take normally, friends. Right. What Toby's talking about is you have a pool of mortgages. And in a mortgage generally is an amortizing type of loan where each month a certain amount of principal is paid back and a certain amount of interest is paid back. What Wall Street went and did and is create something called a strip, where you would get a principal only bond which paid back only the principal payments, or an interest only bond, where the cash flows were only the interest payments portion of the mortgage bonds. So I mean, look, we don't want to get too technical here today. I've already gotten some pretty technical about it. But the point is that we've gotten, you know, some of this stuff has enabled us to do some very, very productive things in finance.
Exactly.
But it's like the chocolate chip cookies. You take it too far, right? Or Laura's peanut butter and chocolate ice cream. You take it too far, you apply it too much, you use it everywhere, you get in trouble.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Toby. Anything else?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Next up is Patrick on line 3. Patrick, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. A couple of observations. To me, it seems like, you know, when the federal government said some years ago, let's open the housing market to create a bigger tax base for municipalities, and, you know, some subprime mortgage criteria was created by the lenders. When you think about it, most people, regardless of income, are going to pay rent or mortgage. They want to keep a roof over their heads. And so, you know, you put most Americans, regardless of income, in adjustable rate mortgages or balloon rate mortgages, and they're going to fail, whether they're paycheck to paycheck or they actually have a little money in the bank. And then for Wall Street to take that money, turn it into derivatives and short sell based on the fact that things could go down and make another level of profits, it's criminal. It's just so criminal. And you use the word we when you talk about Wall Street. Don't include me in the we.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really offended. And I've heard that figure for the subprime mortgage is more like $12 trillion. There's about 6 million mortgages out there.
Yeah.
And we have an aristocracy legislature backed by big corporations. And when America is going to take interest in insurance agencies and banks and hold mortgages, that's socialism. We do not have capitalism. We've got socialism, and I'm furious. There should be people going to jail, and I'm wondering how many foreclosures do you think are happening on the Hamptons and in Wall Street and in the penthouses of New York City?
Yep.
You know, I mean, the whole thing is criminal. And what they're doing is giving $1 trillion in the last days of Reagan's presidency. The legacy is abominable. And another way that it trickles down, and this is the last thing I'll say and I'll let go, is people look at this, and the way this trickles down into the collective psychology of America is that, you know what, it creates further moral decay. People just think, you know what, I should just go out and get mine regardless of how I get it.
Patrick, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Great. Yeah. Patrick said a lot of it. It's a very, very tough and complex issue. How do we promote home ownership in the country, or do we not? Is it important for everyone to own their homes? I think we've gone, my own personal viewpoint is we've gone way, way overboard on that. For many people in this country, it's more important to be able to rent a house and to build whatever capital they have for perhaps more important projects in their lives, maybe education for their children, maybe retirement, a retirement fund, because my belief is that residential real estate does not, over the long term, provide the same type of return on your capital as the stock market. I know that doesn't look like the case right now, right? But over the long term, if we go back 70 years, nothing really has provided the long-term record of investment return that stocks have. It's a fact. It's the record. And so if somebody has managed to build $20,000 of capital, why should there be encouragement to make a down payment and buy a house when they could continue to rent at a reasonable rate in comparison relative to their salary and take $20,000 and put it into an individual retirement account? So it's a very, very tough thing. And yet Democrats have been very much for home ownership for all. I think Republicans have been to a very strong degree also. These are very, very tough questions. To me, they go to the question, as always here on the New Capital Show, of investment. What should we be investing capital in? What provides a return? Who is it most appropriate to make that investment? How do we structure those investments? And Patrick is really driving at something critical. You know, the devil's in the details of how this is done. You know, the devil is in the details, and the overall profile should be reflective of our common humanity and our common caring about each other. And sometimes caring about each other means saying something that's permissive. You know, yes, you can do this. This is good for you. And sometimes it may not be permissive. Sometimes it may be that for certain people, we're better off saying, this is not a good thing for you to do. You want to own your house? You want to pay a lot for that house? It's not the best thing for you to do with your savings. There are other things. Next up, line four. We're going to take Doug. We've got just a few minutes left, and we're trying to move through some calls here. Line four is Doug. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys, thanks. Your last comments about the last 70 years worth of the stock market performing well are really the core of my concerns, and here's what it is. The popular spin is that we're going to go into a recession or whatever, and it's going to be bad for 4 or 5 years. We're going to get out, and the government and our personal investments are going to pay back based on this history of the stock market performing properly. My deep concern is that our economy is based on cheap energy. Cheap energy is not cheap any longer. It's getting scarcer. We can't drill our way out. Alternative energies aren't going to fill everything that we need for the growth that's anticipated. It looks to me like we're going to have to get much more efficient and do with less, not more, going forward.
And we will, Doug. And part of this crisis is leading to that. So that's going to happen. Now, again, I want to emphasize, I'm not telling everyone to put all their money in the stock market. You should have a diversified portfolio.
But, and my concern is just because energy is becoming much more expensive than it ever has been, you know, it was so cheap that people didn't even build it into their cost for years and years and years.
Okay, but Doug, there are going to be companies that are born. They are being born as you and I speak. They're being born not so much in Houston, where I'm broadcasting from, but they're being born in places like Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas, right?
And
if Houston, Texas doesn't get with it, it may not be the energy capital of the world, because energy may become alternative and clean and sustainable in nature and technologized where there are it's already technologized. I mean, look, drilling for oil is a highly technical endeavor, but digitalized where suddenly our houses have all sorts of digital controls on them and can control the consumption of energy much better. All that is coming, Doug. It's going to happen with the cars. I've been talking about it for 5 or 6 years, however long I've been doing this show, and this crisis is going to be one of the main things, if not the main thing, that pushes us to do those things. It's going to happen. Now, hang on. Now, look, when those companies, there is an Apple computer. Apple computer was born in the garage of Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. And look at it now. There are companies that are being born in garages right now that are going to help us and help our country and help the world. to save energy. And
I'm in the renewable energy business, and so I monitor this very, very closely. I'm a Houstonian. I work with the state on policy issues and things like that. And I guess that's why, because I'm close enough to the energy issue where it really frightens me to death that we won't be able to have that high yield for low cost energy that we've enjoyed over the last 150 years. And our entire economy, not only nationally but globally, is based around that almost free energy. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be far from free in the very near future. And I just wonder if our economies can snap to the new reality of very, very expensive energy.
Yep.
And how that's going to affect investment, and whether we really will ever pull out of this and things will start to prosper.
Doug, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All huge questions, all vital questions. The answer is we have a functioning economy. We've got functioning markets. Our regulation has utterly failed, as Patrick indicated. Our regulation has failed. And our regulation is going to have to be fixed, and it's going to be fixed. And you play a part in fixing that, because when you vote for people, who you vote for, they're in charge of the regulations, okay? So you want to see better regulations? Make your vote count. All of this is going to happen, I assure you. The country is going to look a lot different 10 years from now than it does now. And you play a major role in making that happen. And I'm telling you, that people working in their garages right now and in companies that are being funded with venture capital, although it's a very difficult time to get financing right now, it is happening. A deal got done yesterday for $60 million for a company working in solar. That is a lot of money to be put into a company with people as nervous as they are. But it happened, and it happened yesterday. I have great faith that this is going to happen. And one day, that company will go public and list on the stock exchange, just like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak's company did with Apple Computer. And you will be able to participate in a share of ownership in that company. Now, I don't want you to put all of your savings into that company when it comes public. You should own a little bit of it, and you should own some bonds, and you should own some cash, right? But that day will come. Real quick, I want to take one more call. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Laura says, no, we don't have time. My apologies to Wayne, to Herman, to Tag, to John, and to Kibwe. I will be back next week. This topic is not going away. We will continue to focus on it leading up to the election. We're going to turn to the election, of course, as well. But this is the sweet spot of the New Capital Show. We're in it right now. This is hard times for a lot of people, but this is a great time for the show because we are now seeing writ large, writ actual, writ in reality for everybody to see the very issues. And I am delighted that our education level on issues of investment, issues of capital, issues of debt, issues of equity, issues of how things are financed, issues of return on investment, they are now front and center in our national discourse. As my listeners, I am deeply grateful to you. You have carried me along all of these 5 and 6 years having this conversation, allowing us to have the conversation, participating in this conversation until such a time came that others joined the conversation. And I'm delighted to see that others have joined the conversation. It's a big conversation. It's vital to the future of our country and to the future of the world. And it's great that we're having it. That does it for another edition of the New Capital Show. I will be back next week. www.newcapitalshow.com. If those of you who didn't get on, send me an email. I'm happy to have an email dialogue with you, or post your note on our website under the comments section of today's show. People will be happy to correspond with you that way. Great to be with you. Enjoy the weather and take care.
Hi, this is Danny Everett. On Sunday, October 26th, the Houston Association of Acoustic Musicians will be hosting their second annual compilation CD release party. The event will take place at J.P. Hopps House, located 2317 South Highway 6, Houston. If you get lost, call 281-496-0623. Starting at 3 p.m., there will be live music featuring some of the selected musicians from the Ham compilation CD. This year's featured artists are The Hanshaws, T.C. Smythe, Danny Everett, Larry Carr, Bill Ward, Tracy Seegers, Brian Kelenak, Derek Aramburu, Carolyn Wallace, Steve Price, Swafo, Glennis Eastham, Brock Rodarte, Steve Reno, Randy Frisch, Cat Rose, Dave Pierce, Stan Hatch, Sailor White, and Ken Gaines. There will be a potluck dinner, so bring a dish. If you can't bring a dish, just make a donation at the door. See you there.
This is KPFT Houston.
The phone training for individuals, families, and organizations wanting to help the 2008 Houston Press Music Awards Best Radio Station is coming up fast. Trainings will help you take pledges during KPFT's Fall Membership Drive, October 15th to November 1st. The volunteer info session is required for anyone wanting to become a volunteer with KPFT. All who attend the phone training must also attend the volunteer info session. To participate, just attend only one of the following dates. Wednesday, October 8th, the phone training happens 6 to 6:45 p.m. and the volunteer info session happens 6:45 to 7:45 p.m.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.